You're listening to the Limitless, the podcast between. This week is my follow-up conversation with the ungoogleable Michelangelo. Our first conversation was aired at Michelangelo's site. You can find that by going to the link in the show notes. The only reason I'm, besides the loss of time, is just is being a bit fuzzy headed. But I was lying in the sun actually, so soaking.
Now you're speaking in ufology terms again, lost time.
Yeah, maybe something happened.
Sun abducted you. You was trying to coax you into your next Icarus phase.
Oh dear, doesn't sound good. But yeah, it's probably not entirely inappropriate. All right, well, color me disorganized and more liminal than even I like to be. Where do we start?
Well, I'll let you pick a starting point this time. I kind of stormed in last time, and unless you need a little orientation, since you're in a special kind of liminality at the moment.
I do remember everything, I think. I know that you had just read Prisoner Infinity and just listened to my conversation with Luke Dodson. So that seemed to be the general ballpark we were going to circle around, or hopefully pitch and hit in. Why don't we just start there? You said you'd taken notes and things. So
I did. They're very scattered, so I guess I'll match your scatteredness today. I looked over it. I took some screenshots on my iPad too of like little sideline notes. I thought it was a great read overall. It was very compelling. It put forth a lot of food for thought. It was a great journey. This would be a good jumping off point, because I feel that to kind of like touch onto all those different facets. Because out of all my notes, there was one that kind of stood out, and it kind of draws a parallel as well to Prisoner of Infinity as an artifact, and to some of our previous conversation that you drew into your conversation with Luke. Okay. And this regards, it's funny because it regards kind of the notion of self-portraits as other people, or a self-portrait as another person. Because throughout Prisoner of Infinity, you're examining yourself reflected in the convex mirror of a UFO. And specifically, you're examining yourself through the lens of Strieber and Castaneda. And as I'm reading your accounts, in a sense, I'm doing the same. And I wanted to draw the parallel to what we were talking about last time in regards to entering into, say, a plant medicinal interface and extracting something from that realm and leaving something of yourself in there, you know, the strange exchanges we were speaking of. Yeah. And you mentioned when you were talking to Luke, you kind of threw back on something that I had said, which was that when we take something from those places, we leave something in there. And I kind of made the Indiana Jones analogy, right, of like switcheroo, and then the Philosopher's Stone boulder comes rolling after you. Right. And as you recalled that in your conversation with Luke, usually when I hear myself quoted or paraphrased, it kind of like draws me aback and makes me think like, ooh, is that what I sounded like? Like, what was I saying? You know, like, what did I actually was able to convey or bring across? And I thought about it some more, about what I meant by that. And I think it comes down to the idea that, well, first of all, the mind or the psyche is made up. It's a realm that, on the one hand, we explore it, and on the other hand, it's something we create or design as we enter through it. So it's like a user experience, in the same sense that the path you're paving in this book through the eyes of Strieber, who set the experience, who set his experience, quote unquote, in stone that you traveled through. And then you're extracting your footprints from that and you're reflecting that back. So the note I have here is about that idea, and I'll read it to you because it's kind of dense. It's going to have a lot we can unpack here and probably run from there. And it was specifically in regards to something that Castaneda influenced too. There's a chapter somewhere where you talk about, I think, the old masters.
The old seers. I'm just writing about them for the last chapter.
Yeah, the old seers.
So it's time.
And their sense of dreaming being the creation of an all-inclusive realm.
That's exactly the subject of the last chapter of 16 Mounts of Hell. So you're tuned right in.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
okay.
Perfect. And then you tied that into, I think, something from Strieber and the Master of the Key, who was talking about intelligent machines.
Yeah.
And a kind of self-replicating, self-improving technology.
Yeah.
I related that back to, just like we talked about last time, in the beginning was the word, in the beginning of what? In the beginning of the medium, in the beginning of the text. So it's self-referential. I think that those self-improving, self-replicating machines that they're talking about language. And they're talking about language as the fabric of consciousness and as the fabric to enforce reality, to build the user experience through which you can then navigate. And what the master, I think it was the Master of the Key, or maybe it was the old seers, that had mentioned something about these traps, right? The idea that if you enter into this realm that they have created, that they have designed, you could get stuck in there and you can't believe your way out of it. Mm-hmm. And I drew the parallel in that sense to the notion that this is what you used. Hold on, I'm actually going to pull up a quote because it gets very meta at this point, Jason. It feels like on a lot of levels. But you had said, I hope I have this one lined up here. Yeah. Like Strieber, I eventually came to understand that his writings, besides inspiring me, had filled my head with half-baked truths and helped generate a deceptively coherent fantasy of supernatural empowerment. Well, it's interesting because you're drawing on the works of essentially fiction writers as the model with which you entered into hyperspace, virtual space, vegetal reality, as I call it, VR. And they, in a sense, are like the old seers that have created a world that you stepped into. And then you realized that the world you were walking in had a lot of holes in it, that in fact they're the dream that they had set up for you to enter into was an incomplete set of beliefs that were flawed in a sense, and you had to believe your way out of it, but you were trapped. You were trapped in someone else's fantasy.
Disbelieve my way out of it, but yeah.
Disbelieve your way out of it, yeah. Better way to put it. So here, I'm going to read the quote with that preambling ramble in mind.
Okay.
I wrote, Psychonautics/sorcery is really a designing of user experience. So the trappings of entering a dream realm and being able to leave it could be akin to entering another's user experience and taking it as reality and becoming unable to create your own unique take on the abyss malleable mystery. In a way, your examination of trauma and the deconstruction and demystification of the architects of this realm, Strieber and Castaneda, that this realm that has become reified and deified by your participation is indeed the unshackling of conceptual constraints, and the reevaluating of their esteem is the fortification of your protective judgments and the reclaiming of your autonomy. And the judgments part also like casts back a little bit into something I took away from Julian Jaynes from the Bicameral Mind Theory, where he talks about when we listen to somebody speak, we suspend our identity and in a sense we become them. And the weighing measure of that is our judgment, the level of esteem in which we hold the person that we listen to. So for instance, you're right now suspending your identity and becoming me as I inform you with my resonant voice, my resident voice. And, you know, depending on what level of esteem you hold me in, you're going to have your own pushbacks and sidesteps and footnotes going on in your head to like organize this. So it feels in a way that at first you completely let these charismatic entities of Streber and Castaneda in and allowed them to inform you. But then came the point of kind of like the deconstructive reconstruction of yourself, still absorbing the nutrients of what you could take away from their experience, but at the same time also trying to reclaim yourself. And in that sense, you left some of yourself in their realm. You are now inextricably tied to them through your literature, and a part of them is forever embedded in you.
Well, I'd say we have some sort of unresolved history now, certainly, because it was unresolved on my side and I attempted to resolve it, you know, alone. It's a parasocial relationship, what they call them. And did it, but I hope I did it effectively enough to have ripples in their newer sphere. I think I did. I feel confident in some way that I got deep enough. And so, yeah, there's some kind of, there's something there. I mean, I see it as a kind of soul rescue. So I'm rescuing my soul, because that's, I mean, that's my mission, or for me to complete my mission, I have to have all my parts in working order. I've got, you know, my gun, my backpack, all the different parts have got to be there. But somehow, because we're all mirroring each other, it then turns into a kind of shamanic soul rescue of these individuals. The latest one is Roman Polanski, because I realized that with 16 Maps of Hell, I'd written this huge book, but it didn't have a coherence to it. It didn't have a narrative line. And the reason was that I hadn't found the protagonist of the story, i.e. my identification. How was I invested in this book? In a way, it's very clear in Prisoner of Infinity that I'm trying to, as you've just described it so eloquently, I'm trying to restore my own autonomy, my own integrity to myself. And Streber, you know, I gave some of it away to Streber. Well, I hadn't identified the hooks that pulled me to write 16 Maps of Hell. I hadn't, you know, zeroed in on the coordinates when I first wrote it. So it was this big mess I didn't even realize. And then I did, I zeroed in. It was Polanski, his relationship with Manson and that whole nexus. So then I'm, and very significantly, it seems to me, in a synchronistic way anyway, the last chapter, which I had to write from scratch because I realized the book wasn't completed, focuses back on Polanski and his movie, The Tenant, which is about somebody's psyche being possessed by somebody else's psyche, hence the title, The Tenant, mm-hmm. which is the character in Castaneda's book, The Art of Dreaming, which you provided me the page numbers for, is about this character called The Tenant, who creates these all-inclusive dream worlds. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's lots of, you know, this is what we would expect when we're starting to identify that we're embedded in this matrix that's co-created as a learning device, but that we've forgotten what it was for, and so we become trapped in. And then then I would say we've had eons of co-creating it that's just been reinforcing the prison-like nature of it. This is one of my objections years back to the synchro mystics. It seemed to me they were just focused on studying all the intricate details of the matrix for fun rather than actually to locate, you know, the flaws that you've just described, in such a way that eventually they would stop believing in synchromysticism and synchronicities, because it's a second matrix. It's not really, mm-hmm. it's all a game lured to trick us, you know, into never turning it off.
Well, I mean, it's that touches onto the notion of awakening inside that matrix. It's not so much that it is a prison, just that we lose sight of we overlook the overlooker. We become so immersed in the material that we stop looking at what the material consists of, which is ultimately language in its many forms, in the ways we construct it, whether that's, you know, the way we linguistically structure the code, or the, like we talked about, the cinematic ambience that coats our perceptions, or whatever, all the influences that have woven themselves into the field of our perceptions. And the awakening to that is a sense of empowerment and awakening in that structure, right? That's like the disbelieving yourself out of it, or deconstructing your beliefs so that you can come back to the reality. And I think the most compelling thing from Prisoner of Infinity is what you put forth about the idea of the crucial fiction and becoming an unreliable narrator of your own story, mm-hmm. which is something that I hadn't, it's something that I've felt and I've touched onto, but I thought it was a really compelling thing to brand that I haven't heard put forth before in such a way. Because of that kind of terminology, the book also is, like we talked about in the last conversation, a kind of lethal text, where even, like I said, I took a lot of notes, but stepping out of it, it remains difficult to like weave it all into kind of cohesion. Like, it's an experience you go through, and coming out of it, you can have some takeaways, but a lot of it also is very much, it's following you through a thought process and through a kind of dreamscape where, let's talk for a second about the school of fish, about the Thessica Pisces that we touched onto in our correspondence, where we're both, right. We're coming from these, we have an overlap where we're very simpatico and where we can converse. And on the one hand, I'm staring into the darkness on the other side with your kind of the conspiratorial trappings, and you're staring into the darkness on this side with the psychedelic, psychonautic trappings, right? Mm-hmm. So there's kind of like this mirroring that's going on there. Mm-hmm. And I think there is, it's very much like a tessellation, or like an Escher painting, the way that these machinations echo and mimic each other, in the sense that I look into the conspiratorial side, and as it's reflected in Prisoner of Infinity as well, in how what makes me want to steer away from that generally, I feel like the way you approach it is in a much more level-headed way. Like, you're not putting forth absolutes or saying like, it's gonna turn the frogs gay, you know, like lizards and Illuminati, like that kind of trip. Like, you're definitely grounding it into the mysteries of psychological reality and the psyche. But looking at, there's a lot of connecting the dots you were doing in there between, you know, Strieber, MK Ultra, I think the Process Church, mm-hmm. Fabian Society, all these kinds of things, where the reason I've always steered clear of those explorations is because they're endless rabbit holes, they're endless free falls, where you could read, look into endlessly into all these different things that are speculative, secondhand investigations, mm-hmm. that ultimately are also a form of dissociation, mm-hmm. and a way of stealing your attention away from the matters at hand and in your direct life's experience, in the same sense that you staring across the Vesica Pisces into the psychedelic trappings that you've steered away from has its own trappings and dissociations and synchronistic, what I call synchronicities. You know, it's not necessarily conclusive, though. These are the crucial fictions, is in the midst of the free fall, somebody builds a castle in a cloud and says, no, found it. This is it. There's definitely lizards. Definitely lizards and Illuminati, or, you know, like, definitely aliens. But the thing is, it's a continuous free fall, a continuous, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the feeling of infinity. We want to finalize it. The ego wants to nail the waves to the shore, you know, like, we want to find some kind of, we want to finalize infinity, to put it.
And writing a book is a final, it's giving something a final form. It's giving thought processes and deductions and analyses and self-reflections and all of the rest of it. And it does create another narrative, of course. So the idea, you create a narrative that will somewhere, as you said, a lethal text that will disrupt other narratives, is ambitious, of course, because it's almost hypocritical or something, you know. It's almost like, oh yeah, yeah, because if it's really effective, how can you be sure it won't cast another spell, like driving out the nail with a nail? You know, how can you be sure that the second nail will just slip easily out? But I think you keyed in on it with this disbelief thing. It's empowering. I don't really like the word empowering, but nourishing or fortifying my own, and therefore the reader's capacity for disbelief, to be in a state of disbelief. Because we don't want to be, do we? We want to really go from one belief to the next. And we're willing to let go of old beliefs, but only if you give me new ones that are better than the old ones. So certainly I do have this question, but I also think it's incorporated in Prisoner Infinity. I certainly try to get it in there, which is emphasized. And I thought actually when you said the best bit, you zeroed in on what would be conceptually the strongest thing about that book. I would agree. Then, you know, this model of crucial fictions, but that is just a model. And at first I thought you were going to go to my house renovations, because that's just kind of in there and it's not really about anything, and you could just take it out and the book wouldn't apparently be any different. But I needed to bring in something that was going on for me physically at that time that reflected, you know, the intellectual and conceptual exploration, and anchored it in reality. And that's, you know, to extrapolate from that, just as an example, that this book only has value if it was helping me get back to reality. So here's my testimony. Actually, yeah, look, this is happening while I'm writing this book. Maybe not while you're reading it, but something could be happening correspondingly in your life while you're reading it. This book is just a skin of a snake, really, that lets you know a snake passed through here. So whatever, stick it on your wall and frame it if you like it. I'm happy. I like it too, but it's, you know, it's not where the soul is. It's not between two covers. Not where reality is.
It's funny that I use the same metaphor, the skin shedding. I've been reworking my website, and just the idea of an about section is just so daunting, because the whole thing is an about section, right? I mean, that's what a website is. It's just a very intricate about and what it is, the work you're doing. And
yeah.
I described in there somewhere, I said something about like, this is just, you know, a terrain of shed skins and avatar as residue. Of, you know, passing through, because that's really what we're doing.
Yeah.
But I actually really liked that tethering in the magically mundane and the deconstruction of a house that is very much a symbolical representation of your mind at that time, which also had its kind of like psychic residues, right, from previous tenants.
Yeah.
And tenant.
By the way, I've been wanting to mention this for a while, just so we keep it meta and in the physical reality, but you know, behind you have what looks like a UFO painting, and underneath that is a ram, which is my astrological sign.
Well, it's actually these little guys are sea angels. Have you ever seen those? They look like little gelatinous gummy devils underwater, but they're called sea angels.
Right.
And then the ram skull. You said the ram is your what?
My star sign.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so what you say, I'm using the UFO as a mirror. That seems to be mirrored mm-hmm. in your background.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Well, there's one very sort of very specific point that I got almost right away when you started riffing. And this is this question, how we may be creating the psyche.
Yeah.
And I just want to throw it out, I won't go into a long spiel, but because I kind of lost it now, but I want to just juxtapose that idea with the possibility that we're uncovering the psyche.
Yeah.
And that those two are, they might not be mutually exclusive, but they might be.
I'll add to that. Because the idea of excavation is something that's very much in my line of thinking in that regards, there's a story I often tell when I'm on podcasts, which is kind of like an origin story of my own line of thinking. First of all, I say, like, you preserve the mystery in the book by excavating and examining the psyche, and at the same time, you never get into trying to touch onto what the soul is or what the psyche is or how to. There's one point where you say what it's not. It's definitely not a fluid plasma, like,
right.
Like Kripal is trying to put forth, which I'll have something I could add to that too. But I guess I'll get into this story. Yeah, try to pour it in a nutshell in regards to excavating the psyche, or rather the larger body of ourselves, which is that in 2002, I was living in a kind of like the house you were describing. I was living as a property guardian back in Amsterdam in an old dentist practice. It was like a 3-story plus attic, 15-room house that was for sale. And because Amsterdam has a lot of squatters, they put my girlfriend and I inside there as legal squatters, or anti-squat, as they call it, which had a very like anti-Christ kind of like feel to it, right? Like I felt like some countercultural figure. And so we inherited this place for just like utilities is all we had to pay. And you can imagine a place that used to be a dentist practice is haunted in the sense that people bring their dental terrors there, and then that splatters all across the walls, and just like that energy is the anxieties and the kind of like sterile environment that's just been ripped apart. And so we're in this basically like what you were describing, like you lived in an old crack house that you fixed up. Like we were living in this old dentist practice, and the bottom floor, like the linoleum floors, were broken open. There were shattered mirrors. There was a dead pigeon in the boiler room, and we just left that as is. Like in our own little overlook hotel, this was just like the realm of shattered reflections, perils, and death, you know? Like, mm-hmm. Let's leave that as is. And then the second floor was more like the domestic side. We had a bedroom and a little kitchen area, and my girlfriend had her studio space. And then on the top floor, that's where I had my atelier. That's where I would do my writing and painting. And my studio basically had two rooms. One side was my studio. Then there was a wall made of windows, almost like a corpus callosum that split off the two chambers of this bicameral mind that I inhabited. And the other side of it was just empty and darkness. So when I would work there, these windows were in essentially like these mirrors into the other side of myself, right? Where this sort of like shadowy potential that I was trying to extract into my writings existed. Mm-hmm. And one night we took the Eucharist of LSD upon our tongues and went in for an exploration. And I had basically been mapping my own hell in a sense, because I had had a few jarring experiences with psychedelics. And every time my mind would beat me up with itself, and I would take notes of to where I took a wrong turn in order to map the terrain to try and find my way to a grounding central perspective. And I'd been wandering through the streets of Amsterdam and talking to different people who were, it felt like everybody was wandering through this man-made maze. You know, the city itself had always seemed to me like something that had always existed, a reality that we're born into. But after the first psychedelic experience, I realized this was all just like a human construction that was basically like a printout of blueprints made up by the mind that now we inhabited. And I was trying to find a way out of this maze, basically a way out of the prison of my own mind in the form of the city. And within that maze, I'd run into different characters like former Hare Krishnas or Jehovah's Witnesses or whatever they may have been, these people that had these maps, these like meta mazes, like you were saying earlier, like it's just another matrix. They were like, oh, no, this is the way. I have found the way out. It's like, you're still here in the maze with me too, buddy.
What year was this?
2002.
Right. So, because I lived in Amsterdam, it was in 1998.
Yeah. Okay. I was there too at the time. I was a lot younger. But I started looking into different spiritual mindsets, because I felt like I was mentally, I was developing, and as an artist, I was starting to come into myself, but I was terrified of what was beating my heart. There was like an anxiety, like an existential angst inside my heart, and a mistrust of my autonomous biological realities. I was looking for God, basically, the simple way to put it. I was looking for the thing that tied it all together. And so I'd looked into, you know, Buddhism and Taoism, and I was reading the Learys and the Oshos and all the, you know, all the snake oil salesmen in the back alleys of consciousness. And then we took this LSD in order to test the integrity of these structures that I had been absorbing, of these different user experiences that I had been entertaining. And at the early onset, there's a moment after some like sleight of mind transitions where my girlfriend and I are sitting in my atelier by candlelight, sitting opposite each other, staring in each other's eyes, and we're crying. And I just like woke up in this moment and I said, are we crying? And we looked each other in the eye, and then she smiled, and I watched as this like dark matter, this like dark flood started creeping in from the sides and covered her face, all but the eyes. And then she giggled and it retracted, almost like these like octopus tentacles just retracted the curtains. And like, and I said, don't laugh, you scared it away. And she says, if it giggles, I laugh, which was perfect reasoning, and I had to accept that. And then I let the concentration build again, and again these like paisley floods, these fern-like tentacles started creeping in and covered her face until it was just the eyes. And then just like that, I was looking in a different face, and now she had these like dangling earlobes and this like top knot, and she looked like this little Buddha figure. And then I was like, kind of tilted my head, like, what am I looking at? And just like that, this like augmented reality filter changed again, and now she had a blue face, and I was looking straight into Krishna's face, as if like Krishna was sitting right opposite me. And then again it changed, and now she had a big beard, and I was looking at Jesus Christ. Where my girlfriend had been sitting across from me now was a big bearded man. And this one was too much for me. So I broke away. I was like, Jesus Christ. And I went into this kind of inward polarity spiral, like this tumbler of light and dark and angels and demons. And as I tumbled through this confusion, this cyclone of confusion, wondering to myself, like, why did I just see Jesus and Buddha and Krishna in my girlfriend's face? The answer presented itself. You've been looking for these answers. You've been looking for the way out of the maze. These are the masks of the mystery. This is the language with which you can describe this universal love, this sense of cosmic unity that you've been seeking. But this is what it's really like. And then like that, I was back in the room, but the room was now filled, instead of with air as nothing, it was filled with this like viscous energy and colorful strands of energy that seemed to me like undying, unborn, eternal, creative energy, creative, pure creative imagination. And I thought, yeah, eternal creative energy. Yeah, I'd call that God, sure. And I allowed that into me, and it entered me, and I felt more inspired than I ever had. And I started painting three colors, just primary colors on a panel. And I just started moving it around. And these waves of energy would just like wash over me, like these galloping hordes come in from eternity, raining into my shore and just like pouring onto this canvas. And at times I was, you know, I was watching as the brush stroke was creating a trail. And at other times the trail would get ahead of the brush strokes and I would follow it. And at times I would wonder, what am I creating? What am I painting? What's coming through? And a wave would wash over me and I just said, trust, trust. And it would wash away any doubt, and I could continue going, just going, 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 until finally I looked at the painting afterwards. And it seemed to me like a perfect representation of the process. It was like this perfect Krishna-like self staring into a unified polarity spiral with this like nauseated ego cast aside, with a sort of jackal figure guarding it, holding it at bay. And I started thinking about it, or feeling this very strong sense that in the repositories of eternity, however you want to envision that, as like the Akashic records, or like time as past, present, future simultaneously apprehended, everything we create is lying in waiting, waiting to be realized. Basically, like I consider it like a I call it the scryogenic future. So it's a mix between scrying, which is staring into the crystal ball for divinatory purposes, and cryogenic, as in like a frozen future that through the laser focus of attention streams backwards into the present, into the present, so that the future can become realized. And all I'm trying to say with this is that I sensed that everything we create, including ourselves as a sort of self-realizing practice, is really like the larger body of our being, that right now we're poking a small part of it into 3D space and we're experiencing this in almost like a linear fashion. But the entirety of mind, of psyche, of soul is to be excavated, is to be uncovered. And so the act of trust is really the focus with which to bring the mind into reality, which is to say to provide in reality the realities that are not naturally occurring, to bring that little extra bit of Jason or Michael or whoever into the world, and then dusting off the outside influences and conditionings that have influenced us. And in that sense, enlightenment is becoming fully yourself outside of the sources and forces that have shaped you. The end.
Yes, that was quite an epic spiel. A number of things were going on for me while I was listening. The last thing that got my attention was how you said mind, psyche, soul. Mm-hmm. Not exactly making them synonymous, but still putting them all in this sort of in this trinity. Mm-hmm. And So I'll just sort of bookmark that, a sticky note that, because, and put a question mark over it, because it came up with a conversation with Luke, this feeling I have that psychedelics, they expand the mind at the cost of our body and our true sentience, our deeper sentience. I feel quite strongly about that. And also, you began the story with this, the Eucharist, the LSD is the Eucharist, which also speaks to a conversation with Luke, this Leary-esque idea that psychedelics are a way to God, to know God, which I question, although I've had my experiences where I thought, whoa, those were gods, but, you know. So I have to put it, you know, I have to stay on the fence, but let's just say I very much question it. One thing that was going on, which is kind of, it's very meta, it's not directly addressing your recount, your tale, is that, but it relates to something you said at the start, that when we listen to each other, we have to let ourselves become the person we're listening to. For some reason, while you were talking, I started hearing what you're saying as if I were my wife. I was imagining my wife listening to this podcast.
Ephemeral voice of your wife.
Yeah. And I we'll see, we'll find out. But I really felt that she was just kind of rolling her eyes, like she wasn't getting into this story, and that she would be skeptical. I was just feeling this really skeptical energy. Obviously, it was coming from me, but somehow it was like I was calling in my wife to help me. I know I'm getting barraged with psychedelic tales of power. I need some backup. So I thought that was pretty meta, because definitely what there's this thing about boundaries, isn't there? Like, really, I can't remember you didn't use the word boundaries, but you were talking about before about using disbelief judgments in order to establish judgment. Yeah, you said judgment. So what we need to say no to, and why and when, right? And so this, I'm sure this won't surprise you, there's a sort of back and forth going in my head. Well, I don't really feel the way about Michael's story that he feels about it. Like, I'm suspicious of this. I think something else is going on here. But on the other hand, I don't want to just block you and say, well, wait a minute, that wasn't God, my son, that was Satan tempting you, whatever. I could go there, right? Because that's just bad manners and it's not good conversation. So it's like trying to find the middle space between allowing you to have your experience and sharing it, and maintaining my own.
Of course. Well, it's what you were saying earlier about writing a book being a finite presentation. What I was feeling from that too is that it's also open-ended, because you give it to a viewer who's going to lend their own lens to it, and they're going to have their own interpretation. So a book, even though it is a finite expression, it's also an open-ended. The real author is the reader. The final author is the reader, right? Who creates it, who revives the trail of text, who basically puppeteers the snake skin for their own purposes. And so as I relay this story, I know that, you know, I'm presenting you with basically the crucial fiction, the distortion of my actual experience as I've stylized it through my telling, and letting it go through your filter. So first of all, the words are weighted, like words like you're saying, like, well, that maybe that's not God and it's the devil. Like, okay, so what is the God you were looking for to unfold through your entheogenic use, first of all? Second of all, it seems like this God-devil dichotomy is still like the leftover dust of your possibly Christian upbringing, or at least some kind of religious...
Very atheist upbringing.
Oh, that's right. Your father was very much like...
He was an anti.
Nihilistic almost, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but there is very much like it seems like this lens that you wield is very much like a God, the God devil is very much still like a archetypal semi-dogmatic view, even though I don't see you as somebody who sees little figurines, you know, like little action, divine figurines.
That phrase semi-dogmatic is a good one, isn't it? Because it's oxymoronic, but I actually, I'll cop to it. I am semi-dogmatic. I'm liminally dogmatic. I'm dogmatically liminal. I think I interrupted you.
Oh, no, no.
I didn't.
No, I interrupted you kind of because you were just placing your printing out your meta filter of the bicameral wife.
Yeah, well, bicameral, there you go. I think there is a place for God-devil metaphors. I mean, obviously it's a place for them, but I mean, I think they might be indispensable. Mm-hmm. The metaphor of God seems to be, I mean, of course it is. It's the totality. So what's the opposite of the totality? It's a bit confusing. Is it individuality? Well, is it separation?
That's interesting, because if the totality which we'd strive for is what we consider the divine, which we try to unfold through entheogens, through divine unfolding within, right? The sense of, in a way, washing away or suspending for a moment the judgments and boundaries, boundary dissolution, right, is how they kind of play it off. Mind expansion, boundary dissolution. The sense that for a moment we can suspend these borders and boundaries in order to feel the sense of unity with the entirety, then the opposite would be something daemonic, which you trace the etymology of daemonic to splitting, right? Or what was it?
Yeah, I believe so. That was Kalshe, but yeah.
Yeah, so that's where it gets really interesting, because that's another thing I wanted to touch onto from the idea in Prisoner of Infinity. You never touch onto what is the soul, or what are you, like, it's kind of like a given, you know, like, oh, we all have a psyche, you know, like, we all know what that is. We don't need to get into that. We all know what it is. And yet we know so little about how it functions, obviously, that we fall for its trickster-like traps again and again.
Well, but it isn't a given in the book. It's right in the intro that the psyche is the greatest mystery there is. And so I'm juxtaposing it with the UFO, because, like, the UFO is mysterious. Wait till you get into the
Yeah, exactly. And that's very much my line of thought. So even if I'm talking about, like, encountering some, like, tangible hallucination of a creative force, an eternal creative force, that I would say, like, yeah, that's what I would call God, or that's what I would call, like, the divine creative energy, I will invite that in. I feel like mind or psyche or soul, let's give it the Trinity, is pure essence of hallucination. In this, it's almost like think of it like a stain on the emptiness, in that sense, as like a Rorschach, that it can shape itself into all these different projections, such as the aura of your wife or the image of an alien and this kind of thing.
I need to come back to this, because I didn't finish this mind, this correlation with the mind and the psyche, because that's very central to Prisoner of Infinity. Also, that the psyche and the mind are not equivalent, and the mind is more like a crustacean on the psyche, or an implant, or a foreign implant of some kind. So if anything, it corresponds with Satan, I'd say it would be the mind.
Well, I think of it too, when I say the three tiers of it, you can think of it like a distillation, right? Like, if you start off with the nebulous concept of soul,
yeah,
and then you bring that down into psyche, which is kind of the interface, because when we talk about psychology, people aren't talking about soul, they're talking about mind, right?
Well, they think they are, but that's because they don't know psychology.
Yeah.
And because we're so identified with our mind that we think all our problems are in our mind, but really they're in the body.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, I concur. So it's really this distillation and this conflation and confusion of these terms that things get really tangled up in, and that's like the great unspeakable throughout the text that you can't carry away a definition of. But what I wanted to touch on to is the sense that you get into a lot of this idea of, you know, it's not really a transcendental experience, it's just trauma. But what, in a sense, what I'm getting from that too is that trauma is transcendental, and in that sense, that God or the soul is a kind of pathology, paternal pathology even.
Compared to what, though?
Well, exactly, compared to what?
Compared to social... I mean,
if that's the only experience that there is to be had, is the life experience, and if that is so fraught with this kind of fragmentation, like, I think of, for instance, like the Vedanta philosophy, right? The idea that the universe in its entirety is kind of like God, lonely as the one and only. So it splits itself into various facets, the mother of the 10,000 things, in order to experience itself and lose itself like an actor in role play. This is a DID deity. This is a deity with dissociative identity disorders. It's a ventriloquist that is constantly, even as we're conversing now, like, I am a symbolical representative of your own interior, yet beware, because...
And the clue there to me would be that we're projecting our dissociative... If we see God as a DID case, then probably we're projecting.
But that's the exact point, isn't it? That we're projecting. That it's a projectionist reality.
I mean, that's the point of crucial patients in prison or infinity, but or the thesis of it. But the point is that there is a God, and there is a body of love, to use Norman Brown's expression, outside of the fragmentation and outside of the projection, which is eternal and unchanging and not very exciting at all. I mean, by definition, mm-hmm. but it's the only place where there's real life.
So let's look at that then, what that would look like, because you're saying it's not very interesting or it's kind of boring, and it's basically just the, you know, like, oh, just da-da-da-da-da, Postman Pat, you know, like living in a body and tending to the garden and just like tending to...
No, because it's look at the state of the world and humanity, right?
That's true. But that's also because of all the mental illness and the confusion and the dissociation from the body, I think, and from the earth. And as you sketched out, how basically the blind spots are co-opted in a way to seduce us away from the earth, seduce us away from the material realities of life force and biology and just the shall we say truth of existence, to use a dirty word. But at the same time, this was another thing I wanted to touch on to, is again touching onto that Vesica Pisces in a sense, and of the divergence, is that since you're coming from kind of the existential detective side of things and looking for through a very pragmatic lens, I think you're artful and skillful in your examinations, while at the same time you're trying to reel it all in. Like, you're not making any unnecessary sidesteps. There's a couple jokes in there which I very much enjoyed, like the circus sideshow Barker, where you do like a little, mm-hmm. you have a little moment where you're having some fun with it. But for the most part, you try to stay on a very pragmatic path. Mm-hmm. And I come from the side of, you know, as an artist, and I deal in fiction, even if it's spiritual fiction that's grounded in my own experience. Not unlike like a Philip K. Dick Vallis kind of character, where it's like the, you know, the fictionalization or mythologization of one's own story. I feel like I can take more of these kind of poetic and artistic liberties, mm-hmm. through which the dissociative process, or say the visionary flight, has its merits that can be brought tethered back into, which is why I think I'm a pretty balanced and functional individual for the most part, is that I'm able to use my neuroses or use my pathology in a way, it's like, okay, I'll allow this to exist, but it's going to go into this project or into this thing. It's like channeling it into a place where it can't interfere with life. And I think this is a big, say, paradoxical dichotomy that takes place in the thinking of humanity nowadays. And we'll bring it to for a moment here, and this could become a whole side stream, but to Eric Davis.
Good, yeah.
Because you mentioned it too when you talked to Luke, and I know that was recorded the day after we had spoken.
Yeah.
And you said you didn't bring up the Twitter conversation with him that you had, because Eric and I are friends to some degree. And I did stumble upon that, and I think I mentioned it in the correspondence too, which it was kind of a counterproductive conversation, very entertaining as an outsider to look at that. It had some very fun mm-hmm. moments, but there was a lot of kind of there was a combative attitude from the start, and it started off with you getting a little cheeky right at the start, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you stepped in, it was about the article about kind of overlap, spiritual bypass, red pill, conspiracy, new age overlap kind of trip, right? And the author had ended it with a kind of victorious hurrah because there was a tweet where one of the Wachowskis, we'll just say, I don't even want to say Wachowski, one of the Wachowski siblings stepped in and said, fuck you both, to like Ivanka Trump and Elon Musk or some, I don't remember who it was.
Reference to them using the red pill, yeah.
Yeah, so, and then you came in and you said something like, to claim some kind of victory because of a tweet from somebody who had their dick cut off, some guy who had their dick cut off, and Eric seemed offended or like pushed back, and he said, your pathology is showing.
Yeah.
And then it became this whole kind of, you didn't see eye to eye after that point, even though you retracted at some point saying like, okay, I was a little rude, da, da, da. The reason I bring this up is because obviously what you said could be construed as transphobic, which is probably how he might have taken it, and why there was an offense there of like, hey, that's, you're not taking into considering the humanity of this person and you're being rude. But this is, I think, comes down to like the trans argument, is that there's a split in humanity where the one side of the argument looks at things from a very evolutionary and biological and materialist perspective to a degree, right? That no gender, it's, you know, you're born in this, the body reflects what you are. And then there's the other side, which is more the, let's say, the art, the spiritual confabulation, and the theater of humanity, where we're sidestepping the assumptions of saying things like, I was born in the wrong body. It's like, in the body. So you are the separate little homunculus. You are the linguistic entity. You are the I think, therefore I am, not the I am, therefore I can think. You are this separate being that is in the body. Okay, let's look at that for a moment. In the body. Where in the body are you? Well, you can probably locate it somewhere around the head, right? Is how you'd identify with it. And why is that? Because that's where you're seeing from. If your eyes were on your knees, you'd probably think that the eye was in your knees.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this like hallucinatory mind space behind our eyes, where we do our reasoning, where we have our little private theater. And as James proposed too, like, when I look in your eyes, I invent the same space there. But it's ultimately, it's a hallucinatory metaphor generated model.
Yeah.
The idea that when you close your eyes and I tell you there is a rat holding a paintbrush, then you see a picture like this. I think this is a William Burroughs quote, though I've never been able to trace it back. He said, you see an image of a rat, but that is not an image of a rat. It is an image of the word. Metaphor generated model. And this, I think, is nebulous territory, so I'm not going to touch on that much further. But I just wanted to paint that picture of the assumptions of the soul that are worked into the legislative body of the law and of the way we view the world, that are largely unexamined. And most conversations on these topics only go skin deep. Nobody dares to touch onto what is the soul or what is the in the body thing, because these are based on speculations and assumptions. And this is where things get nebulous, right? Or where like an argument about this, you know, like for instance, the trans identity thing, or so many things get confused. Anyway, I think I've said enough. I'll give you a chance to.
We certainly do. We didn't turn out to be about Eric Davis. So I guess we'll sticky note that, because that's a whole path. And also you mentioned Jeffrey Kripal earlier. So instead you went into this question of who is the I that's identifying independently of the body, which is an absolutely central question, I agree, when it comes to the transgender issue and of course to human existence at large. And yeah, I'm not going to break any new ground here by saying that I haven't found this I. You know, I challenge anyone else to show me their eyes, and which is back to the mind as well. Like, what is the mind if it's not, internally generated matrix of language that starts, you know, about 2 years old and eventually takes over our whole nervous system. Because and this is a meta. I mean, this is a very large subject. I'm not sure how much it. I think it does. I can bring it back to what we've been talking about eventually, but it'll be a long way around probably. But I recently found out that identity was postmodernism, because postmodernism is about questioning the possibility of any objective reality and therefore basically questioning the reality of everything. They realized that would be impossible. If they just, you know, swept everything off the table, there'd be nothing left. I mean, just everything is up for grabs. It's pretty much how it is. But they say, okay, we've got to hold on to one thing that's absolutely reifiable, and that was identity. So identity has become the equivalent of the old Christian religious idea of soul. And so now we have the postmodernists and the progressives, and you say the artists and the quasi pseudo spiritual. They're not really, I don't know, there is an intersection there, but certainly the progressive artists, liberal types, who don't believe in the soul. They reject it as patriarchal, religious, you know, and so on and so forth. And certainly, you know, that's not part of the machinery or the edifice of their ideology.
Did you say that's edifice or Oedipus?
The edifice of their Oedipal ideology. Probably is Oedipal, because they're trying to possess the mother's body. I mean, these trans men, anyway. Trans women. You don't even know what to call them. You put trans in front of it, but they're trans men who want to be women. Those ones, it is Oedipal, I think, an Oedipal edifice. But identity is the thing that is reified and raised up. And you were talking about theory of mind, so I thought we could bring it back to feelings I was having when we were talking earlier. Like, yeah, when we look at each other and we let each other into our internal space and we connect and we vesica piscis with one another psychically. What is it that's happening there potentially? I would say that, and this also brings back to psychedelics, you know, this idea that we can have an experience of God and the divine that bypasses, I would say, our inherent biological and psychological reality as cells in a human organism. That we are all not interchangeable, but connected and inseparable. There's no way to separate your psyche out from my psyche, because there's only one psyche that has fragmented off into many different bodies. So the life force, the spirit, the human spirit, the human psyche, and the human life force has distributed around many bodies. And then these bodies, through sustained trauma, have generated these identity mind selves that now I can keep insisting, no, I'm me, and I can be whatever right. I want to be, and that includes I can even be, you know, something I'm not.
You're touching on this. This is some very potent soil, I find. And literally what you just said, to a degree, that somebody took something from a conversation we had and turned it into a meme, something I said, which basically comes down to the exact same thing in relation to past lives and the idea of, like, what we think of as soul. Like, in a past life, I was Napoleon's. Like, who was what? Like, it's life force continuously recycling itself simultaneously instead of these separate islands of identity that are really fortified. They're fortresses of self to keep us safe from the ocean of indifferentiated awareness. But also, I was looking at the word identity, and I always think of it as like an id entity, right? Yeah. It's like this wholly unconscious, impulsive, instinctual identity. And I think of it in the terms of Buddhism and meditation and the idea of don't identify with your thoughts. You know, like let them pass like clouds through the sky of mind, rather than, again, like clinging to a castle in the clouds and making it your home. Mm-hmm. Crack house castle in the clouds. It's so funny, because also, again, looking through the Jainsian bicameral lens and the idea that there was a one side of the brain that would hallucinate a hierarchy in order to give advice in critical junctions when the automata animalistic body couldn't make decisions for itself because it was too complex. And then the god or the king or your wife would chime in and say, whoa, whoa, hold on, no, go left or go right or do this thing, do that thing. That later through, I think, the printing press cast a shadow between gesture and motion, where we created the metaphor-generated model in which we have an analog self or a homunculus or the little I inside the body who gets to do the deciding, the identity, the ego.
Right.
But it also was limited. So it came up with divination as a way to summon the omens of the divine rather than waiting for the synchronistic wink from wherever. It would, you know, cast lots in order to summon this decision and make these decisions, which later it gets co-opted into the lottery or into gambling habits and things like that. And which is where we're at now, where that ego is now in charge and is in a sense reified and deified and is the central truth in the postmodernist worldview that you're putting forth in your description. And this is, it's so dangerous because it's so limited, and that's why we're in the situation we're in right now in the world, I think, is because we have a very difficult time making these decisions without tuning into, let's say, the hallucinated guidance of a higher self, deeper self of psyche or soul.
Why hallucinated?
Well, I'm bringing it back to the bicameral notion.
It has to be translated into something we can see with our minds or identify with our minds, and therefore,
right. Which I consider, like, hallucination gets a bad rap because of the delusionation idea, right? That it's like a deluded view. But I feel like there are hallucinatory states as subtle as thought itself, and there are hallucinated states as luminous as a divine experience, which could be a dissociative ploy, of course, like you've put forth. But I think that when I refer to hallucination, I'm talking about psyche, or let's say the unconscious, or the mind of the body itself stepping forth into form or voice to make itself known. It could be like we were talking about earlier or in the last conversation, as like sensation as a voice.
Yeah. Right?
Where you feel a gut feeling.
Could even be action, was what I was thinking, because
yeah,
it's possible that the most direct connection to the divine would not exactly bypass, but wouldn't require these intermediary states of subjective impressions, would simply move embodied, and we would then witness through our senses the way we were acting in the world, and then we would know what the divine wanted, so to speak.
Yeah, we can interpret our own actions in slight hindsight, which is also the soul mind psyche trip I was putting forth. I see the mind in the middle of that as the interface between those things, right? It's like, it's more like the lens. Like, if, for instance, say soul as body is doing the doing, is making the action, then that gets interpreted through the lens of mind. And then I guess psyche would be like a larger, but let's not get into like the tangles of this stuff. I wanted to touch on, because you had mentioned as well, you talked about William Blake and the marriage of heaven and hell is something you bring forth a lot. He had a line in there somewhere where he says, the notion that we have a soul as separate from the body needs to be expunged. Yes, I have been shown by hell.
A key quote, for me,
Yeah, same here. I, in my work with ayahuasca early on in my early 20s, I encountered something that was, I call it a saucer mind at the time, because I felt like it was an intelligence that encompasses us at all time. It like disguises itself as the surroundings, and it can beam us up into its realm. And I thought about this a lot reading back, reading in Prisoner of Infinity as well. And this was also, I think, very much influenced by Philip K. Dick's Valis and the chameleon principle, the idea that there's this like being of high order mimicry that can surround itself as the surroundings. And I called it a saucer mind because at times it would appear as a kind of like visionary saucer, which I saw as kind of like my own projected soul or totality, like beaming back at me from some, you know, buried body of eternity trying to like transmit to me. But I was mapping basically the line between, because this was the thing about the chameleon saucer mind, was that it was able to use my own voice. It was able to use my thought patterns and behavior patterns to give itself form. So when I would hear in my head negative thoughts or something that was compelling me in a certain direction, I would question this and I would tune in. I'd be like, whoa, hold on, like hold up the mirror to this thing. And at times it would uncloak itself and basically like flutter off because I had recognized and intercepted it as something cloaking itself in my habits. So I realized I needed to become more fluid and less predictable in my thinking and behavior in order to evade it.
Right.
And there was a moment of realization where I was sitting in a hammock and I'd been listening to the sound of the cicada. And the first few times the cicada came out, I was like, oh my God, something put that thing out of its misery. My God, the suffering of that creature. But in this moment, I was listening to it and it sounded like a rainbow disc of light. Like angels were singing. Mm. And I was like, that's so interesting that I was projecting my own suffering and tortured mind onto this sound.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was laying in this hammock, nauseated, and I felt like I was just like suffering. I was suffering. And then my friend said, oh man, you've got that big ayahuasca grin on your face, man. And I came to the conclusion that the body has a mind of its own.
Mm-hmm.
And that we tell ourselves these stories. Like I was telling myself that I was suffering, that I was, you know, I was basically buying into the bullshit of this snake that was swallowing its own tail. Basically, it was saying, you have been banished from the garden. And by listening to it, I was banishing myself.
Mm-hmm.
When in actuality, my body was firmly rooted in a kind of paradise. And a kind of like sensational embodiment that was evident from the smile on my face. And when he called me back into that moment, I realized like the cicadas sound like angels. I'm doing all right right now, like bringing it back to the reality.
Mm.
All that to say that, yeah, the body has a mind of its own and its own unique intelligence. And to bring it back to McKenna for a moment, and I don't know you don't want to hear this.
Mm-hmm. But you're going to.
But he put this forth as well. He said, the mystery is in the body and the way the body works itself into nature. Rising from the reef.
Song of death that sung to me with magic empathy. could hypnotize or paralyze for all eternity, or tie willful mortal men to the mast of their self-mastery.
Yes, well, the truth comes from all kinds of dodgy sources, and it doesn't necessarily validate the sources. It may also tarnish the truth, I guess, is very much one of my messages throughout my work, is, you know, the dodgiest sources of all are those who are recalibrating the truth in ways that have all kinds of hooks in them. So, but I mean, it's a visceral thing for me. At least I want it to be a visceral thing. I'm trying to keep it as visceral as possible. And I mean, I want to stay on that and what you just said before the McKenna impersonation, because it was about subjective versus objective, seems to me. And you see, the postmodernist and even the spiritual, the quasi-spiritual view is that, in a certain sense, everything is subjective. Everything is God and all is one, and so on. However, we get, obviously that wasn't the postmodernist version.
It's like a solipsistic notion almost.
Eh? And it, my point here is that it puts the body on the same level as the mind, as being a hallucination also. And I don't think there's really any basis for that, because there's nowhere to go from there. I think the only kernel of some truth in there is that as physical bodies, and this is the Blake thing as well, what does it mean if the soul cannot exist as distinct from the body? I would say that what he means there is an individual soul, that you or I as an individual soul is indistinguishable from the body, because it's our body that makes our soul individual. Now, and there might be a whole process there which speaks to your point about maybe we're also creating the psyche in some way. But without getting to that, physically, yeah, we have this consciousness that is subjective. We're subjectively experiencing our own body, and yet our bodies are all part of the earth. Your body is connected to my body right now, physically, by the air, by the earth underneath us, by the atoms and molecules, you know, etc. We are actually physically connected. That's not mysticism. And so even at that level, you could say the idea that we have, you know, separate bodies is somewhat illusory, but not the idea that there is such a thing as a physical body, unless we want to start going into, you know, is this a simulation? Is this a world created by Castaneda's old spheres? And of course we can go there, but then we're strictly hypothetical. Or just right. Maybe it is, but I'm just saying, if we stay within the what appears to be going on here is that there is subjective experience and there is objective reality. And one example, to bring it back to the Eric Davis thing, of the difference is it's a subjective experience to say I'm a woman in a man's body. It's an objective reality that a man had his penis cut off, and that we need to remind ourselves of the objective reality and the facts. And in this particular case, it can be shocking and brutal. Although I would want to ask Eric, hey, what's the big deal? If you think it's so wonderful and glorious that this person has discovered their identity, what's wrong with cutting his penis off, right?
Why you did ask this to a certain degree. You did reel back from the initial remark. You did reel it back into the what's wrong with what I said, or but I think it comes down again to that split, like that people can't seem to agree on whether the reality that you just painted off is objectively verifiable versus the subjective reality, which I would consider more the theater of the mind. And I want to step back for a second, because you brought it up a couple times now about what I said about the mind, making the mind up or creating the mind. I think a better way of looking at it is mind moving through the domain of psyche or the domain of soul and painting the walls. Let's put it like that.
Or pissing on them.
Or pissing on them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, exactly. It's marking territory. It's talking shit. Mm. It's because ultimately soul is unspeakable. I think we can agree on that, right? It's, you can feel it, maybe you can articulate, maybe it can be cinematically encoded, or
the body can articulate, like our whole body can articulate the soul. So.
Yeah, but it's not like for instance, calling you Jason, that's not your name. That's just a handle by which to summon you, but you actually are a name. You know, like if you can't remember my name, call me by my face, because that's a closer representation of that.
Yeah.
So the idea of like making up the mind is to say, to map it, to map the soul through the mind so that the lens actually becomes as closely a representative of it rather than slipping it away into distortion. But
like a transparent mask, you mean, like a persona that you can see through.
Yeah, but basically wearing a mask of your own face, or as Stephen Wright so beautifully put it, I got a tattoo. It's a full body tattoo of myself, but taller. You know? The best way to encapsulate this idea. Slight distortion is always going to be there. It's always going to be slightly taller. Yeah. But this is something I find interesting, because I am a theatrical being, but I also, because I mean, personality is performative, especially in a world of CCTV and surveillance states and things like that. Mm-hmm. The world is your stage. Well, now it's prompts more performative personalities. It's reality TV. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of reasoning goes from the point that that's the ultimate reality. Just like I was saying, like being born into a city, into Amsterdam, and always just assuming that this had always been there, rather than that this was just a human dream that had been built into the world. We've literally lost touch, like lost sensation with that link to primary reality of obviously the earth, because we're definitely destroying that, and in effect the body and the biological truth. And so I think there's a flight into theater as being more valid, because that's what we're moving towards. And I think this is what you're pinpointing in Prisoner of Infinity and through your examinations of how there are forces that are seducing us away from those realities into kind of living out of fiction and enforcing that fiction in the form of, you use the example of space travel and the space program and this futurist transhumanist reality, right, as kind of like an ideal that a lot of forces seem to be conspiring to literally uplift. And I thought of, you mentioned Kurzweil in there a few times.
Yeah.
A great example of this, I don't know if you know who Jason Silva is.
Have you ever heard of him? Yeah.
So he's this kind of like zealous techno-evangelist who has been very ironically dubbed the Timothy Leary of our time. Even though he's a very much like a proponent of the psychedelic experience, from what I understand, he maybe recently had his first experience, but he's been just like you were saying about Anthony Peake, I think that he's kind of like a proponent of it without having actually subjected himself to it.
Mm.
But I enjoy Jason Silva's zeal and the way he's able to put his words together, even though at times it sounds like he's just vomiting with this kind of like overexcited thing that he can't contain in his body. There's a lack of criticality, especially I noticed it in this one video, and I commented on a number of them and had some comments deleted and never responded, which was also a red flag to me, because it's not like I was trolling. I was very eloquently putting my points forth. Where he was talking about, Aleister Crowley talks about summoning the will from the environment and magic and like all this kind of stuff. And he's like, and now we have our gadgets and our iPhones, and we just press a button and an Uber shows up, or you get an Airbnb with a touch of a button summoned out of nowhere. And it's like, brother, you're not looking at the big picture. It's like you're forgetting one essential line in this spiel, which is built on the back of slaves, proletariat, you know, like there are people driving those Ubers that are just trying to survive while you and your little elite gang are pressing the buttons and summoning the cars and making your reservations, but you're not taking into account that in this elevating simulation, there's still a bunch of slaves shoveling coal to engine the furnace, you know?
Yeah, it's H.G. Wells' time machine and Metropolis all meshed into one.
Or The Congress, did you ever see that film?
No.
That's one. Oh man, I really feel like you're going to resonate with that. It's based on a Stanislav Lem.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't want to lose the thread here, though, because I'm perceiving a correlation as above, so below here, because what you're showing, the humanity, there's a certain isolated portion that wants to be able to control everything in its environment, but it's basically pushed these Morlocks under the earth who will just keep throwing coal in the furnace to keep their perfect world going. That seems to correspond with what's happening in our bodies. And I think you just mentioned something about going numb or losing sensation. Yeah, you said losing touch with sensation. And I was saying earlier when you were talking about this homunculus, that's a very visceral description of how trauma causes us to withdraw our senses from the body into this isolated realm, and so that of the mind, where we won't have to experience the terrifying, traumatic nature of reality and what's happening to our bodies. And of course, the result of that is we turn our body into an avatar. We basically try and turn our body into this machine that just carries around our little homunculus identity. And we, because we're just identified, we won't get hurt. You look just like Jim Carrey there. It's quite eerie. You turned into Jim Carrey for a second.
It can happen sometimes.
Anyway,
influence.
It's really eerie. You look so much like him. Have you heard that before?
In some degree, it's that I've been compared to him, and more like in personality than in looks. But
okay. All right. Well, I have this thing with the Grinch. Now I can't unsee it. Now I'm just seeing you as Jim Carrey, so I'm getting starstruck. But I have this thing I call the Grinch, which is how the trauma embedded itself in my nervous system and actually turned my body into a living hell. So kind of the reverse of this. I was fortunate in some way that my soul sensitivity or my connection to my soul was strong enough that my attempt to withdraw in the mind just caused me endless agony in my body.
It's the body calling you back.
Yeah, the body calling the soul back and pushing the mind out. But it's still, there's some overlap there, because obviously I didn't want to be in my body because of all the agony. And so it does seem as though this process does lead to a numbing of the body. Like the empowerment of the identity involves turning the body into a kind of dispensable, disposable machine that can have apps added and bits removed, chopped off, whatever, because it's just the carrying device for the identity. But of course, to turn your body into a machine means that it no longer has real sensory capacity. So we're creating a body that's numb to existence. And so then, of course, we become numb. We have no empathy if we can't, theory of mind is no substitute for empathy. If we can't feel sensory pain, the most baseline thing of pain, which is sensation, then we're not going to feel any other. And this is my last point, and this is the theme, central theme of 60 Maps Hell, is the theatre of cruelty, which was a surrealist, part of the surrealist movement, Antonin Artaud, Nietzsche, and then the surrealists kind of picked up on it in different ways, and then Beckett even in the 60s, and then Polanski. It's throughout our culture, the avant-garde has this thing about the theatre of cruelty, which is that if we're in these bodies that we just use to carry our identity around, we can't feel anything, we lack empathy, and we're desperate for sensation, we get more and more driven, like Michel Foucault with his sadomasochism, to experience our bodies, and right. So we intensifies the cruelty and thereby the dissociation and thereby the cruelty.
Well, it makes me think too of the trope of like lizard overlords seems to speak to that, and the idea of the not that there's actual lizards lording over people, but the reptilian cortex, and that part of the brain that's much more cold-blooded, and you can chop off the tail and it doesn't really matter, it'll grow back, this kind of like unfeeling psychopathic way of being in the world. And the Jason Silva trip also, it's like what plays out in him a lot from what I see is just his fear of death because of his identification with the homunculus, and that wanting to upload that into the cloud or preserve that somehow. And also when you look at, say, an L. Ron Hubbard type who is no longer around, but has literally or figuratively, but to some degree literally, stored himself not in the cloud, but has stored the worst parts of his personality in the all these clones, you know, and all these people that follow him. They basically have been indoctrinated and implanted with the worst parts of him, his aversion to psychology, psychotherapy, and so many other books and
right.
traits.
Well, that speaks to what I was saying about McKenna as well, that a person can have some truth and good qualities, but somehow what ends up is these hooks. So with McKenna, for example, or this weaponized thing that's full of hooks to reel people into distorted ways of being. With McKenna, for example, his main trip is DMT, you know, and mushrooms. And so the more truth comes out of his mouth, the more people are likely to think, oh, DMT is a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. So that, and then with Leary, and Streber, obviously, I mean, I go all the way to the bank with Streber in terms of the Trojan horse that his ministry seems to be. But what was I saying? Leary, he claimed to feel that he was continuing the work of Crowley.
I read that
and this guy Jason Silva is just blathering about Crowley, has no idea, no clue the kind of sociopathic
maniac. And that's what I feel Crowley was. That lack of criticality, or even like, and I noticed it too. Actually, I learned about Silva because he was in conversation with Eric Davis. Because he's a huge Eric Davis fan because of Technosis, which is a terrific book, I think, very interesting. But you saw the first conversation between the two of them. Eric is very poised and chill, and like Jason can hardly contain himself in his body and just like flailing his arms about. And it's just like, because this whole thing is shots of awe. He's like a wonder junkie, which already the terminology there, it's like, hey, tone it down, bro. You've got a problem. And it's all about, he's like, this proponent of kind of like sensory overload. And it was really interesting to see kind of Eric like reel him back and be like, yeah, I'm not that interested in the overload. I'm just trying to like tune into like different facets and trying to like keep myself grounded and this more critical perspective, you know, rather than the kind of like getting really high on an idea without really looking into it fully first.
Well, I don't know Silver and I haven't listened to the interview, but as long as we're back on Eric, my beef with Eric is he is nowhere near critical enough, and he's so uncritical, I feel, that he's enabling. Certainly Kreipl, but also Pasulka. He had Pasulka on his podcast, and that's a big disinformation shit pile, in my opinion, American Cosmic. And I think Eric himself, I feel that Eric himself is... It's. I mean, I don't want to definitely want to make about Eric. He can't hear. He's not here to defend himself. But with generally what we're talking about, or at least in relation to what we've been talking about, where is our allegiance? Is it to the mind, or is it to the soul? Is it to the identity, or is it to the soul? That's the key difference. And there are a million different tales. And I'm not saying, of course, it's not either or. It's a spectrum. It's not a literal war of individuals, thank God. It's a war within each of us. But with Eric, there's just been so many tells in terms of where his allegiance seems to be, in terms of the questions he's not asking and the things he's propagating. And it's disappointing to me. I mean, it might sound like I'm his brother or his mother or something there, but I mean, I feel a lot of affinity with him.
I think it's because there was a kindredness, essentially. I think there was a mutual admiration there that I feel that's maybe where the disappointment comes from. And why you're saying like, it's like a brother, which I think you brought up in conversation with him too.
I definitely feel that way. I just feel we're quite similar in many ways. Like his personality anyway, is quite similar to what mine, even physically, are quite similar. He's short and I'm tall. It's definitely mutual respect. I wouldn't say admiration. I'm not actually a fan of Eric's writing particularly. Because I don't find any traction in it. It just seems quite academic in the not great sense, just impersonal. But definitely his speaking style and his podcast. I don't listen to any podcast. It's one of the only ones I would listen to for enjoyment because he is so level-headed. So I find that confusing. And I talked about it with Luke. Like, if he's so level-headed and he's such a good thinker, why is he not? How can he not question something like Jeffrey Kripal, which is just so much BS around Kripal. And it's not, well, I mean, of course, there's personal interest there for Eric, so that's the easiest place to go. Well, and I don't particularly want to go there, but it, and I say I don't want to make it about Eric per se, but this, on the other hand, you know, we could talk a lot hypothetically, and it's, it is good to bring it down to brass tacks in terms of what is this about? It's about what you're talking about at the beginning, developing our powers of disbelief so that our subjective experience corresponds more and more with objective reality. And so for me, one of the central tools for that has been looking at the culture, and specifically the culture I'm in, which Eric's in too, and you're in, the alternate perceptions community, for the tells, for the holes, for the lies, for the distortions, for the dissemblings, and I've just found so many, and I've mapped this nexus with Prisoner Infinity and Vice of Kings, and now 60 Mounts of Hell, and well, Eric is, you know, he's in that too. So then he's kind of a, I mean, Strieber would never talk to me, but and I have no idea how that conversation would go. Obviously, Kripal, he was supportive of me. Like he gave money to my first Patreon, and he was sent me his book, Authors of the Impossible, and he was super friendly. And actually, that made it harder for me to really, you know, take him to task. But when I did start really looking at it, and I shared it with him, and his responses just kept dodging. He just kept dodging and dodging. Eventually, I started to feel that his friendliness was not genuine; that it was strategic.
Yeah, I see that. Trying to keep you close because you're up to something, and trying to dismantle some of the illusion or something like that.
Well, even before that, though, because he didn't necessarily know I was going to do that. So, but just initially, like a strategy for, you know, okay, here's a potential ally, but therefore also a potential threat. So yeah, let's do all the, you know, the necessaries to get him on side. And when that wasn't working, well, you know, kept trying for a while, and then just, well, we both really gave up because he never answered Prisoner Infinity. I had a copy sent to him, never, didn't expect to hear back from him. And now with Eric also, I had copies of Prisoner Infinity because he's in the OTO, which is great. You know, it's just,
what's that?
The Ordo Templus Orientis, which was the secret society that Aleister Crowley became the head of and reconfigured it completely. So he's affiliated with Crowley, if only by joining that thing. Now he can have all kinds of explanations for it. I don't think he's a vocal advocate of Crowley, but nonetheless.
Kripal or Eric?
Eric. Mm-hmm. Kripal is an advocate of some very dodgy things, I'd say, that trauma can be good for the soul, and that the soul is electromagnetic plasma that can be harnessed. He didn't go there, but there's some red flags for sure there.
Well, let's look for a second there at the trauma is good for the soul. There were a lot of things in Prisoner of Infinity about inflicting trauma, especially on children, as experiments in order to kind of break into superhuman realms or paranormal realms or crack the shell to get to this kind of like transcendent transmission or to create some kind of mutant intelligence or however like you want to frame it, which it had some very strange overtones to me, and I think I asked you this in an email, but you didn't respond to it, to this film Beyond the Black Rainbow. Have you heard of that? You've seen it?
Only from you, if you mention it.
Yeah, so it's a film by a guy named Panos Cosmatos, which is already a great name. He also did Mandy, which I loved. Yeah. But he has a very Kubrickian, Lynchian aesthetic, so I feel like you would enjoy it, even if just for those echoes. But Beyond the Black Rainbow, it's very much, looking at it, it's very much the blueprint of what the Duffer Brothers turned into Stranger Things as a kind of like, you know, vintage porn, you know, or like what they call it, nostalgia porn. Nostalgia. But it's very much about this scientist who did these experiments on his daughter in order to open up this kind of like portal into this darker realm of the psyche. And I'm pretty sure, like, after reading the stuff you were writing about, I was like, I'm pretty sure that Panos Cosmatos is privy to these kinds of pieces of literature and thought stream.
Right.
Yeah. But that was the other thing that, like, this was probably it's not that it wasn't appealing, but the least appealing part of Prisoner of Infinity is there's a lot of touching on to these kinds of conspiratorial corners and like connection of the dots between things of where Strieber was at a certain time and his potential affiliation with different organizations and the craze and pedophile rings and all this kind of stuff, where it feels like you're touching on to these kind of like penciling out these constellations that feel like you could endlessly dig into these things and just get completely lost in this world where it becomes another filter through which you start to view everything. Because even in our correspondence about kind of the psychedelic world being close to misinformation engines and potentially even like pedophilia rings, I think you touched on too.
Absolutely, UFO as well. George Hansen totally confirmed that. He said that the UFO circles are, he made a joke about it anyway, the pedophilia and UFOs.
He was the trickster, the guy wrote about the trickster, right?
Yeah. There's something about these worlds that they overlap and intersect. But I mean, the most obvious and undeniable one, which is in Vice of Kings, is occultism and occult secret societies, intelligence agencies, and child trafficking, sex trafficking rings. I don't really have any doubt about.
I mean, more and more of that with the Epstein case, more and more of it is coming into the surface and being pushed back away, it seems, also at the same time, that maybe there is some like huge revelation coming up about all that, about these powerful circles. But there's also, I mean, there's obviously a nuanced examination to be done there, because what happens a lot of times in the mainstream or even like the social media outlook of it is that everything gets, so like everybody is to some degree complicit or to the same degree complicit, right? Like anybody that's on this list knew about it and is involved in it, and it becomes this very
guilt by association. But that's, and I'm aware of that danger, of course, and then certainly I do have a tendency to feel that way. But it's, there's a real side to that, which is there is a guilt by association, which is the guilt of complicity. If one is moving in those fields and one is aware, well, either way, if one isn't aware of that kind of stuff is somehow consistent with it or coexisting with it, like Kreipl with Esalen, if one isn't aware, then one must be complicit, you know, unconsciously. One's actually just choosing not to see it, chosen.
Or not knowing who to turn to or what to do about it, right?
Well, yeah,
if there are a lot of powerful forces involved, then including, you know, like CIA, FBI, and you might turn to at that point, like.
Yeah. So that would be the complicity of being aware. And actually, this is, you know, a thought experiment I did with Eric. I thought, well, maybe Eric is aware of this, but he's strategically placed himself within that and is trying to do the most good he can, knowing that if he starts to talk about those things, he's going to lose the standing he has. And so he won't be able to do anything about it. Well, you know, that's a bit of a reach. I don't really believe that, but I can't disallow it. You know, I have a relationship with Jonathan Leatham. We're much more buddy-buddy than me and Eric, and Leatham certainly doesn't, he reads my books, he likes them, but he's certainly not, you know, putting it into his work, or, you know, he's successful and well-placed, and he's pursuing his own, I won't say agenda, but let's say his interests, and I don't feel that with Leatham. But then, of course, Leatham is in a different field, he's just writing fiction, but anyway, this idea that I feel with Leatham, he's kind of undercover. He does know about stuff and he's trying to communicate it through his fiction. And that's the way he's doing it. And not everyone is just an out and out whistleblower the way I am, to the point I'll even try and blow the whistle on people I have on the podcast, not usually when they're on the podcast, but maybe later I'll go, oh, you know that guy I talked to a while ago, Peter Lavenda? I think he's probably involved with occult, you know, ritual sex abuse of children kind of thing. That if I see it, I'm going to call it. And I don't really have sympathy for somebody who wouldn't. And that includes calling bullshit. Right, but it's partly temperamental.
Maybe that does come down to the strategic, the holding of position, because you've very much stepped outside of any kind of ambition. It seems like you're definitely a very ambitious writer and a very prolific writer, but you've also downgraded your life in a way where you're very seem to be very satisfied with just the simpler things. Like you're not trying to gain clout in, you know, be like a featured speaker at the Ozara Festival or whatever. You know. Right.
Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket like a boombox on your what? Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket, then you drop it like it's hot. Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket like a boombox on your what? Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket, then you drop it like it's hot. From a stone age to a rock epoch, plug into the earth, you get culture shocked. This lyrical, satirical, a chemical comedy, historical, hysterical, botanical harmony. You seek a plant to get you stoned, bear with it, child. The dead, heavy as a boulder. Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder.
Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket like a boombox on your what? Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket, then you drop it like it's hot. Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket like a boombox on your what? Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket, then you drop it like it's hot.
GPS. Got lost inside the endlessness. Gave up the compass in my chest and oriented to the west. Taoists are always in the way. They have no need to navigate, and gypsies don't need GPS. They're at home inside the emptiness.
He's a bard, a ward, and a bard, a card. Motherfuckers like that got a lot of heart. Every beat is a gamble and a fateful art.
The end by blue.
Place your bets
inside of you.
No regrets.
La 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 la, little rules just like roulettes.
Could it be I finally went viral? Just swirling round in spiral, 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 spiral.
Bloom now, flower child, do as thou wilt. Shake off the shame and strangle the guilt. Transcendent of sameness, the shamans are shameless. Shame on you, all else remains nameless.
And I could get into a diatribe about a tribal diet, but you can't deny it, you just gotta try it. If you don't do it that way, you might end up dying. But we all end up dying, don't we? We all end up dying. So
carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket like a boombox on your what? Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket, then you drop it like it's hot. Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket like a boombox on your what? Carry my casket like a boombox on your shoulder. Carry my casket, then you drop it like it's hot.
Some ill-fated rumor, his spiritual growth had been mistaken for a tumor. He heard laughter from hereafter with his sixth sense of humor. And in a vision he was shown
time.
Yeah, no, I'll take that. I mean, I'll take that as a compliment, and thank you.
And it allows you the liberty to move around more freely in what you say.
And that's
say
why. Yeah. I mean, well, there's two reasons why. One, I recognize it was a foreign implant that was driving me into misery, you know, trying to stay in stasis in a world I had nothing but contempt for. And the other is, what was the other? I've forgotten what the other one was now. what you said, because I need the freedom. I need to be able to say whatever I want. Okay, yeah. Chips fall where they may, because I can't imagine how anyone could, as I say, with Leatham, he's a fiction writer, so he's got freedom, but with Eric, I can't imagine being confined in that way and restricted, not uncripled. Oh, he's, I mean, just forget it, with Cripple. To not be able to follow leads where they take you. You know, I didn't start writing Prisoner Infinity about organized child trafficking. I started writing it, well, actually about Cripple's essay. It didn't even start as a book. I'm just like, interesting thesis. Let's pick this apart. And you know, the whole thing came unraveled, including my whole identification as an alien abductee, and it started to unravel internal.
Well, through your dreams, right? Through those dreams that you described. That's kind of your
my alien abductee thing. Yeah. Sure, but I mean they're good enough. Those dreams. Mm-hmm. Reading them back, that's good enough. As good as Strieber's quasi nonfiction, right? Just because it's a dream and Castaneda, he's whatever. But yeah, I really did feel that stuff's happening to me. I still leave it open, as you know. I don't sweep it off the table. But anyway, what was the point of this? Just being able to be the existential detective and get to the truth and get to the bottom of what's going on in the world. I mean, maybe it doesn't have a bottom. It could in a certain sense be,
I think it might be bottomless.
It could certainly become counterproductive if one becomes too dogged and too strident and too driven. I wasn't really driven to expose Strieber. I mean, I didn't try particularly hard to wake up his fans or change people's perception of Strieber per se. Obviously the book has that aim, but it isn't primarily for people who are into Strieber, obviously. Self-evident, it's not primarily for UFO people, and Vice Kings isn't primarily for, obviously, for Thelemites and Crowley followers, because they'll just piss all over it, you know, or just throw it away in horror and disgust and so on. So I'm writing for a very, very exclusive kind of audience in that way.
Well, I mean, there's takeaways for all kinds of audiences just by association, I think. I mean, the fact that you're looking through this depth psychology lens, and I think you mentioned something in the book too about most people that touch onto depth psychology, they just kind of like juggle archetypes and kind of like the fun mythic parts of it, but aren't really looking into the deeper pathological implications of it all. And I found that very, I say refleshing, because you're bringing it back to the body, but the for me, I mean, I like to examine counter narratives, because I'm a fluid thinker. I have my experiences, but I'm not taking them at face value. I like to look at them through different lenses. So for me to look at my own experience through the lens of dissociation, and seeing like what am I hiding from myself that through these experiences is trying to like reintegrate or trying to bring back to myself, I find that very interesting. I think a lot of people could benefit from that angle or from that lens. You know, it's like those Viewmasters, the little toy that you put the different lenses in. It's like, now you're looking at Taj Mahal, and now you're looking at this thing, that thing. Like it's just another lens through which to weigh the experience. And I think it's very valid, because otherwise it is going to be some kind of monomyth in which, yeah, who knows what gets co-opted from the blind spots, or where where things get ushered towards what ends they get ushered.
I mean, since writing Prisoner of Vinegar, or at beginning around that time, for whatever reason, I suppose because of what I was publicly writing and talking about, I've become more and more cognizant of people out there who have been traumatized and have been sexually abused as children, sometimes systematically, sometimes ritually. And so that what was once another hypothetical reality, like the JFA conspiracy or the UFO even, became much less so. And you're talking to people who've experienced it or claim to or believe that they have. And seems as the primary audience for Prisoner of Vinegar was that, in terms of like the most meaningful responses I've had from people who found that it was healing for them to read Prisoner of Vinegar. And that to me would be the acid test. Like, if this speaks to survivors of deep psychological trauma related to similar kinds of extreme abuse, whether or not it was embedded in a more overtly sinister and systematic conspiracy, but including that as well, that then I've succeeded. You know, I've represented something that needed to be represented. So then that is sort of juxtaposing, you know, at the one end of the spectrum, at the other end of the spectrum, it's juxtaposed by, well, Strieber and Kripal. And the sort of conspiratainment, but the alternate perceptions thing that's all about the, it's not necessarily the new age thing, because it's not necessarily all, it's not unicorns and rainbows and stuff, but it's shamanic self-initiation, transformation, you know what I'm talking about. It's not exclusively entheogen related, but definitely that's the general ballpark I'm talking about. Where it's all that stuff's under the rug, because if you pulled up the rug just a little bit and showed one little corner of what was underneath there, like one damaged child, and said that's part of the tale we're spinning too, but don't worry about that, you can't just say never mind the raped child there. As soon as you allow that there's a raped child in there that's part of all these ingredients, then the whole thing starts wobbling, and people can't, they're just, well, wait a minute, what about the rape child? Oh, and of course they might actually just try and forget it and just say, no, give me more drugs. So I suppose it could work it could be used in a weaponized way. I'm not excluding that. But generally, if there's a healthy kind of level-headed approach, then as soon as you start to include, well, yeah, there was some overlap there between Strieber and Process Church that might explain some of these experiences. And the Process Church were also moving in circles that seem pretty close to Jimmy Savile. And we know that Jimmy Savile is working with the Cray twins. And look, there's a consistency of philosophies and methodologies here that relate to traumatizing children as part of an intelligence operation that's kind of global. It's not conclusively saying that these people are linked and affiliated, but it is saying that's the big picture, that's the tapestry, that so Strieber and his UFOs is just one coordinate on that tapestry.
It's a cave painting that's leaving a mark pointing in a certain direction, so that at least in your passing, that's, you left that mark behind of something that you found pointing in a certain direction for somebody else to further follow that trail further than you're able to.
Well, that too, but I hope that I justify is not quite the word, but the markers that I, the dots that I join, create a picture that I can then use as a lens, like you said, in the viewfinder, to examine the nature of trauma and the nature of the world and the nature of the psyche in the way that is useful and therefore validates the picture that I've created. Because if it is just a map, but if the map helped us to get where we were wanting to go, then we know, okay, it might not be perfect, but the main coordinates work. Right? Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, the proof has to be in the pudding. It has to be its own proof. if this shows more clearly the nature of trauma and the nature of the psyche and the nature of the world and how psychism and pseudo-spirituality seems to be, at least some of the time, a dissociative displacement activity for really dark stuff or a way to just cover it all over, then probably the examples I'm using are good examples. It doesn't mean they're guilty per se, but they're complicit and they're involved in something that they either should want to know they're involved in, or they're admitting some sort of guilt.
Well, it's funny because living in the United States, it's this kind of uncovering of trauma is happening on like a larger scale right now, you know?
True.
The whole nation is now starting to look at, I mean, it's always been there. It's like, again, Burroughs said something like, this country has always been cursed. You know, the evil was waiting there before the Indians, before the settlers. Uh-huh. The sense that, you know, now we're starting to look at it like, oh, systemic racism. Oh, it's almost like this place was built on an Indian burial ground, you know? Like,
right.
And then there's also, of course, the dissociative denial of these things. And it's just interesting. Trauma is very trendy these days.
It's true. And it's, I would say it's the counterfeit and it's the counteraction. It's a way to try and neutralize a real awakening, is to create a surrogate one, which is really it's a revenge narrative, is what I see. I see this pseudo-awakening as basically white men bad, white men, we punish white men now, right? And then we'll be good people. Even if we're white men, we'll punish ourselves, and now we'll be good, meek, castrated white men.
I think Tarantino has a big part in that with his revenge fantasies, first with the Kill Bills and then the Glorious Bastards and the Django Unchained and all this stuff to satisfy this unconscious fantasy. Striking back at your oppressors. And I think that that's like kind of a lens through which the less nuanced thinkers will look at the world. And it's really, it's a battle for nuance, it seems, right now, right?
True.
The nuanced ground.
The liminal ground, isn't it? So either or. Mm-hmm. Before you get to neti neti or part of neti neti, you know, not this, not that, it could be either this or it could be that, or maybe it's both. So, and the thing is scapegoating is because it's so innate in us, is the René Girard thing. It's so innate in how societies organize themselves. It's like we can't do without it, without this Jesus solution of just turning the other cheek. That will scapegoat the scapegoaters. I mean, that's how it just goes around and around. Like, scapegoating's bad, kill those people, they scapegoated, right? And we won't even see that we're doing it because it's instinctive and it's so deep that, and this is the really liminal position, and people don't realize this, you know, about me, because it's hard to articulate. When I'm exposing the worst evils in the world, I'm not necessarily judging them. I'm not necessarily saying, look, Kuiper or Strieber, and definitely Crowley, might have been complicit with raping children, therefore they're evil. I'm leaving that last part to people. Like, maybe they had a reason. Maybe it was necessary. Maybe scapegoating, you know, maybe it was a lesser of two evils. I happen to think there's probably nothing more evil than raping a child, but I don't know. And I know that anyone who does anything is justified in their own mind, right? And when we're talking on this very high level, big picture stuff, whether it's Strieber with his cosmonautics or whether it's Crowley with his Horus, you know, channeling, or Epstein with his MIT connections and his transhumanist eugenic things to create superhumans, whatever the fuck he was into, you can bet that they've got some uber boosted, you know, rationale, which is, well, maybe it's about saving humanity, maybe it's about destroying humanity to save the earth, maybe it's about killing the earth to save, you know, who knows, but somehow they believe they're saving something.
Well, you also painted off kind of the image of the totem and the taboo in the sense that society is run on sustaining taboos and then circumventing them sacrificially in order to keep things in balance by horrific sidesteps, which I thought was also very compelling and jarring kind of psychology to expose. And who knows, and there's obviously there's also like the power grab. You also mentioned somewhere there was a whole paragraph about the almost like the unification between abuse and abuser, in the same sense that, like, you know, in a tribal initiation of like the hunter and the hunted, two go in but only one comes out, and like in the moment of the kill the two become one, and like the how the abused empathizes with the abuser even as their vital essence and power is being absorbed by them. There was like a whole twisted interplay that you laid bare in that I mean, the reason it's so disturbing is because it exposes something about our inherent psychology, I think. And like you're saying, that the sense that nobody's ever the villain in their own mind. Mm. And if they are exposed to be that, immediately there's a deflective, defensive, protective mechanism in the psyche to, again, gloss that over in some way, unless you can actually get to the trauma and the realization and find integration and healing through that.
Yeah, and so then that extends to identification with figures, and so you're talking about the abused, empathizing with the abused, I would say identified is closer to what happens at rebirth. Mm-hmm. But so then people who read whoever it is, and like me and Strieber, they identify with Strieber or Crowley or whoever it is, their heroes. Or their teachers, and so then if I come along and say, well, look, yeah, there's some good stuff here, but look at that, what do you think, how do you like those apples? The reaction is going to be what you said, because to them, in their value system, that's bad and that's evil, then they don't want to go there, so then there's a kind of, well, it's just a natural defensive reaction which reinterprets the evidence, I would say, as if it were an attack, because they feel like they're under attack, having, like Michael Jackson fans, you know, right. They felt that Michael Jackson was under attack after he died, because some adults came forward and said he abused us as children, and they all rallied up in defense of Michael Jackson. Well, they weren't really defending Michael Jackson, they were defending themselves and their own attachment to an investment in Michael Jackson, because their identities were very heavily invested in that.
Yeah, and it's also difficult, I think, for people to separate the artist and their art, you know? If you love the music, you might, you feel like that by rejecting the man and the horrors that he's inflicted, that means the music, or like the divine part of this devil, is also cast away. And that's, again, comes down to the nuance and the like finding the both and rather than the either or.
I think it's finding your own center, isn't it? Because if you're drawn to transference or projection onto some artist, you probably didn't have a sense of your center to begin with, and you were hoping they would help you. And then when that's the projection, you know, sort of the worship mechanism, and when that gets compromised.
Well, there's another thread that came up that I hadn't addressed yet, which is, it used to be that, for instance, psychedelic culture and experience was all geared towards mind expansion, boundary dissolution. And right now the story is much more, like I said, trauma is trending, and it's much more about, the dialogue is about setting boundaries, which again comes down also to those judgments, right? The like levels of esteem in order to keep yourself, your identity from being overwhelmed or co-opted.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see how that narrative has evolved over time. And I was also going to address, because I know you have the outlook that entheogens are trauma inducing or destructive to the body in a sense, but I never heard you address things like what MAPS is doing, for instance, where they're using these substances in order to treat, for instance, post-traumatic stress disorder and all that kind of stuff. So it seems like obviously set and setting plays a big part in it, and the ability to confront and integrate trauma and things as they come up, rather than the more like chaotic settings where people just want to run with some narrative.
Well, and of course the difference as well would be, you know, the subject themselves. And I don't know enough about the specifics of that, but certainly as a general principle, extreme circumstances require extreme measures. So if somebody's a heroin addict and you can give them some ibogaine and they'll be off heroin for at least 6 months, I can hardly see that could be a bad thing. I'm not saying it wouldn't be risky, because if you're talking about ancestral possession or whatever, I mean, who knows? But my point is that they're probably going to destroy themselves anyway. And then that's a whole different context, isn't it? For the psychonaut who just wants to turbo boost his life and storm heaven and, you know, bring back some sacred objects to, you know, to put on his shrine. There's two chalk and cheese, isn't it? So I don't know, it's the simple answer. As far as using plants to heal, I think that they do, but I'm sure they might. I don't think that there's some sort of nefarious thing put there by the devil. I think, you know, the devil's in us, and we know how to use anything for self-destructive purposes. I mean, that's our master, isn't it, currently? So yeah, the idea they would have healing properties doesn't contradict the idea that they would be destructive to the nervous system, because that's true often of medicines, that there can be poisons.
Well, this is one of the things that I like about Eric Davis, and where I do feel like he's bringing a critical voice into that realm, is that because MAPS very much is trying to propagate the idea of psychedelics as healing agents, and he's often brought up the notion that they're also tools of sorcery, you know, medicine and magic, and there's a lot of weird dimensions to it that are not being addressed in that model. And that it's just focusing on this kind of like miracle drug or like healing practice, where it's, of course, they have to sidestep all that stuff in order to get it to some semblance of legality. You have to weed away you have to sweep a lot of under the rug, in order to make it socially palatable. But yeah, it's all a work in progress, you know. I mean, all of reality is still very much under construction, put together at the last moment, and we're all.
Well, I think the principle, I'm gonna have to wind up actually, but maybe it'll be a point to end on, I don't know. But the principle that I constantly come back to, and I'm coming back to now, is that of the Trojan horse. It seems to me that that's a really great mythical story, and the world is full of Trojan horses and individuals and groups who will build or find all the Trojan horses they can. And they know how to turn just about anything into a Trojan horse. Maybe I should say we do, so I don't want to make it us and them. And I think for me, the entheogen, which has been rebranded as the Trojan horse for God, which I think is a big bullshit sandwich, is a brilliant Trojan horse. I mean, if you can get just about anything into it, if you can get people to think God's in there, then clearly you can get anything in there, smuggle anything in there. So I would say, and maybe that's the point you're saying that Eric's making, that yeah, just because you say, hey, this is going to work for your healing, doesn't mean that there aren't other things smuggled in there, whether by humans or just already in there by the plants, they could be a heavy price to pay. I mean, yeah, they might bring about some sort of healing, but maybe at the cost that you let some id entity possess you, and you know, hey, I'll fix all your problems in exchange for this, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, and also the idea, I don't think it's that God is in the substance anymore, that the interior of the house is in the key that unlocks the door, you know.
But God is in everything. I mean, God is immanent. So I would say,
right,
and therefore God's in our bodies. So why not go straight to our bodies? You know, why go out?
Well, it's not separate from that. I mean, eating something, what's a more bodily function than ingesting something?
Yeah, but it's not. It's changing your experience of your body in order to have an experience of God. So my point is that if the body is God's incarnation, then it's already there. So we don't eat a meal in order to feel more filled with God. So why would
like you had mentioned in another talk, I forget where it was, about being so disconnected that you needed a shock to the body in order to come back into the body, and that's the function that this
might have had. So that's the thin end of that
trauma. The defibrillator, if you will.
That trauma enlightenment edge. And I do think the thin end is that has some merit. Well, that's the Trojan horse again, isn't it? We wouldn't shoehorn it into our psyches if it didn't seem to fit very nicely. And so there certainly is something about shocks bringing us back into the present and into our body. But life is full of natural shocks, even the shock of beauty. Go out and look at a mountain, for heaven's sake. And that might bring us back. I'm looking at a mountain as I say that.
Well, I'm right now, life is a shocking pressure cooker that's really carving the canyons of my character. So that's my mountain, is an inward holy mountain.
That's the end of my conversation with Michelangelo. Music you heard is from Michelangelo. He also wrote a very poignant review of Paper Tiger, which you can find at the Paper Tiger page at the website. By the time you're listening to this, the 16 Maps of Hell campaign will officially have ended. Though I will keep the page up, and I will keep receiving donations to the fund up until the final submitting of the manuscript to the printers, at which point I have to order the exact number of copies, so that will be determined by the amount I manage to raise before that date, probably in early to mid-September, I would think, so probably another month. People can help to increase the print run of it. As far as ordering your copy, I would also do that now anyway, just because I can't be sure there will be any extra copies, or how long they will last, and so on. That's it. Next week's podcast is with the mysterious disappearing and reappearing Dan Mitchell of Luminosity. Changes in the stars change with the night. Strangers in the heart stay up until light. Dangers in your soul, they motion to the stars. Changes in the heart change with the